The Shining by Stephen King. About the author. Stephen King grew up in Maine and has lived most of his adult life there. He is currently living in the Lakes area of western Maine with his wife, Tabitha, and their two children, Naomi and Joe. Dedication. This is for Joe Hill King, who shines on. Author's note. My editor on this book, as on the previous two, was Mr. William G. Thompson, a man of wit and good sense. His contribution to this book has been large, and for it, my thanks. S.K. Some of the most beautiful resort hotels in the world are located in Colorado, but the hotel in these pages is based on none of them. The Overlook and the people associated with it exist wholly within the author's imagination. Quote from E.A. Poe, The Mask of the Red Death. It was in this apartment also that there stood a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. And when the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that at each lapse of an hour the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause, to hearken to the sound, and thus the waltzers, perforce, ceased their evolutions, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company, and while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly, and they smiled as if at their own nervousness, and made whispering vows, each to the other, that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then there were the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before. But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. Quote from Goya, The Sleep of Reason Breeds Monsters. It'll shine when it shines, folk saying. Part 1, Prefatory Matters. Chapter 1, Job Interview. Jack Torrance thought, officious little prick. Ullman stood 5'5", and when he moved it was with the prissy speed that seems to be the exclusive domain of all small, plump men. The part in his hair was exact, and his dark suit was sober but comforting. I am a man you can bring your problems to, the suit said to the paying customer. To the hired help it spoke more curtly. This had better be good, you. There was a red carnation in the lapel, perhaps so that no one on the street would mistake Stuart Ullman for the local undertaker. As he listened to Ullman speak, Jack admitted to himself that he probably could not have liked any man on that side of the desk, under the circumstances. Ullman had asked a question he hadn't caught. That was bad. Ullman was the type of man who would file such lapses away in a mental Rolodex for later consideration. I'm sorry? I asked if your wife fully understood what you would be taking on here. And there's your son, of course. He glanced down at the application in front of him. Daniel, your wife isn't a bit intimidated by the idea?
Wendy is an extraordinary woman.
And your son is also extraordinary?
Jack smiled, a big, wide PR smile. And we like to think so, I suppose. He's quite self-reliant for a 5-year-old. No returning smile from Ullman. He slipped Jack's application back into a file. The file went into a drawer. The desktop was now completely bare, except for a blotter, a telephone, a tensor lamp, and an in-out basket. Both sides of the in-out were empty, too. Ullman stood up and went to the file cabinet in the corner.
Step around the desk, if you will, Mr. Torrance. We'll look at the hotel floor plans.
He brought back 5 large sheets and set them down on the glossy walnut plane of the desk. Jack stood by his shoulder, very much aware of the scent of Ullman's cologne.
All my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all, came into his mind, for no reason at all, and he had to clamp his tongue between his teeth to keep in a bray of laughter.
Beyond the wall, faintly, came the sounds of the Overlook Hotel's kitchen, gearing down from lunch.
top floor, Ullman said briskly. The attic. Absolutely nothing up there now but bric-a-brac. The Overlook has changed hands several times since World War II, and it seems that each successive manager has put everything they don't want up in the attic. I want rat traps and poison bait sewed around in it. Some of the third-floor chambermaids say they've heard rustling noises. I don't believe it, not for a moment. But there mustn't even be that 1 in 100 chance that a single rat inhabits the Overlook Hotel.
Jack, who suspected that every hotel in the world had a rat or two, held his tongue.
Of course you wouldn't allow your son up in the attic under any circumstances.
No, Jack said, and flashed the big PR smile again. Humiliating situation. Did this officious little prick actually think he would allow his son to goof around in a rat-trap attic full of junk furniture and God knew what else? Ullman whisked away the attic floor plan and put it on the bottom of the pile.
The Overlook has 110 guest quarters, he said in a scholarly voice. 30 of them, all suites, are here on the third floor. 10 in the west wing, including the presidential suite. 10 in the center, 10 more in the east wing. All of them command magnificent views.
Could you at least spare the sales talk? But he kept quiet. He needed the job. Ullman put the third floor on the bottom of the pile, and they studied the second floor.
40 rooms, Ullman said. 30 doubles and 10 singles. And on the first floor, 20 of each, plus 3 linen closets on each floor, and a storeroom, which is at the extreme east end of the hotel on the second floor, and the extreme west end on the first. Questions?
Jack shook his head. Ullman whisked the second and first floors away.
Now, lobby level. Now, here in the center is the registration desk. Behind it are the offices. The lobby runs for 80 feet in either direction from the desk. Over here in the west wing is the Overlook dining room and the Colorado lounge. The banquet and ballroom facility is in the east wing. Questions?
Only about the basement, Jack said. For the winter caretaker, that's the most important level of all, where the action is, so to speak.
Watson will show you all that. The basement floor plan is on the boiler room wall.
He frowned impressively, perhaps to show that, as manager, he did not concern himself with such mundane aspects of the Overlook's operation as the boiler and the plumbing.
Might not be a bad idea to put some traps down there, too. Just a minute.
He scrawled a note on a pad he took from his inner coat pocket. Each sheet bore the legend, "From the Desk of Stuart Ullman," in bold black script. Tore it off and dropped it into the outbasket. It sat there looking lonesome. The pad disappeared back into Ullman's jacket pocket like the conclusion of a magician's trick. Now you see it, Jackie boy, now you don't. Well, this guy's a real heavyweight. They had resumed their original positions, Ullman behind the desk and Jack in front of it, interviewer and interviewee, supplicant and reluctant patron. Ullman folded his neat little hands on the desk blotter and looked directly at Jack, a small, balding man in a banker's suit and a quiet gray tie. The flower in his lapel was balanced off by a small lapel pin on the other side. It read simply, "Staff," in small gold letters.
I'll be perfectly frank with you, Mr. Torrance. Albert Shockley is a powerful man with a large interest in the Overlook, which showed a profit this season for the first time in its history. Mr. Shockley also sits on the board of directors, but he is not a hotel man, and he would be the first to admit this. But he has made his wishes in this caretaking matter quite obvious. He wants you hired. I will do so. But if I had been given a free hand in this matter, I would not have taken you on.
Jack's hands were clenched tightly in his lap, working against each other, sweating. Officious little prick, officious little prick, officious...
I don't believe you care much for me, Mr. Torrance. I don't care. Certainly your feelings toward me play no part in my own belief that you are not right for the job. During the season that runs from May 15th to September 30th, the Overlook employs 110 people full-time. One for every room in the hotel, you might say. I don't think many of them like me, and I suspect that some of them think I'm a bit of a bastard. They would be correct in their judgment of my character. I have to be a bit of a bastard to run this hotel in the manner it deserves.
He looked at Jack for comment, and Jack flashed the PR smile again, large and insultingly toothy. Ullman said,
The Overlook was built in the years 1907 to 1909. The closest town is Sidewinder, 40 miles east of here, over roads that are closed from sometime in late October or November until sometime in April. A man named Robert Townley Watson built it, the grandfather of our present maintenance man. Vanderbilts have stayed here, and Rockefellers, and Astors, and DuPonts. Four presidents have stayed in the presidential suite. Wilson, Harding, Roosevelt, and Nixon.
I wouldn't be too proud of Harding and Nixon, Jack murmured. Ullman frowned, but went on regardless.
And it proved too much for Mr. Watson, and he sold the hotel in 1915. It was sold again in 1922, in 1929, in 1936. It stood vacant until the end of World War II, when it was purchased and completely renovated by Horace Derwent, millionaire inventor, pilot, film producer, and entrepreneur.
I know the name, Jack said.
Yes. Everything he touched seemed to turn to gold, except the Overlook. He funneled over $1 million into it before the first post-war guest ever stepped through its doors, turning a decrepit relic into a showplace. It was Derwent who added the roque cord I saw you admiring when you arrived.
Roque?
A British forebear of our croquet, Mr. Torrance. Croquet is bastardized roque. According to legend, Derwent learned the game from his social secretary and fell completely in love with it. Ours may be the finest roque cord in America.
I wouldn't doubt it, Jack said gravely. A roque cord? A topiary full of hedge animals out front? What next, a life-sized Uncle Wiggily game behind the equipment shed? He was getting very tired of Mr. Stuart Ullman, but he could see that Ullman wasn't done. Ullman was going to have his say, every last word of it.
When he had lost $3 million, Derwent sold it to a group of California investors. Their experience with the Overlook was equally bad, just not hotel people. In 1970, Mr. Shockley and a group of his associates bought the hotel and turned its management over to me. We have also run in the red for several years, but I'm happy to say that the trust of the present owners in me has never wavered. Last year, we broke even, and this year, the Overlook's accounts were written in black ink for the first time in almost 7 decades.
Jack supposed that this fussy little man's pride was justified, and then his original dislike washed over him again in a wave. He said,
I see no connection between the Overlook's admittedly colorful history and your feeling that I'm wrong for the post, Mr. Ullman. One reason that the Overlook has lost so much money lies in the depreciation that occurs each winter. It shortens the profit margin a great deal more than you might believe, Mr. Torrance. The winters are fantastically cruel. In order to cope with the problem, I've installed a full-time winter caretaker to run the boiler and to heat different parts of the hotel on a daily rotating basis, to repair breakage as it occurs and do repairs so the elements can't get a foothold, to be constantly alert to any and every contingency. During our first winter, I hired a family instead of a single man. There was a tragedy, a horrible tragedy.
Ullman looked at Jack coolly and appraisingly.
I made a mistake. I admit it freely. The man was a drunk.
Jack felt a slow, hot grin, the total antithesis of the toothy PR grin, stretch across his mouth.
Is that it? I'm surprised Al didn't tell you. I've retired. Yes, Mr. Shockley told me you no longer drink. You also told me about your last job, your last position of trust, shall we say. You were teaching English in a Vermont prep school. You lost your temper. I don't believe I need to be any more specific than that. But I do happen to believe that Grady's case has a bearing. That is why I have brought the matter of your, previous history into the conversation. During the winter of 1970-71, after we had refurbished the Overlook, but before our first season, I hired this unfortunate named Delbert Grady. He moved into the quarters you and your wife and son will be sharing. He had a wife and 2 daughters. I had reservations, the main ones being the harshness of the winter season and the fact that the Gradys would be cut off from the outside world for 5 to 6 months.
But that's not really true, is it? There are telephones here, and probably a citizen's band radio as well. And the Rocky Mountain National Park is within helicopter range, and
Well, surely a piece of ground that big must have a chopper or two.
I wouldn't know about that, Ullman said.
The hotel does have a two-way radio that Mr. Watson will show you, along with a list of the correct frequencies to broadcast on if you need help. The telephone lines between here and Sidewinder are still above ground, and they go down almost every winter at some point or the other, and are apt to stay down for 3 weeks to a month and a half. There is a snowmobile in the equipment shed also. Well, then the place really isn't cut off.
Mr. Ullman looked pained.
Suppose your son or your wife tripped on the stairs and fractured his or her skull, Mr. Torrance. Would you think the place was cut off then?
Jack saw the point. A snowmobile running at top speed could get you down to Sidewinder in an hour and a half, maybe. A helicopter from the Parks Rescue Service could get up here in 3 hours, under optimum conditions. In a blizzard, it would never even be able to lift off, and you couldn't hope to run a snowmobile at top speed, even if you dare take a seriously injured person out into temperatures that might be 25 below, or 45 below, if you added in the wind chill factor.
In the case of Grady, Ullman said, I reasoned, much as Mr. Shockley seems to have done in your case. Solitude can be damaging in itself. Better for the man to have his family with him. If there was trouble, I thought the odds were very high that it would be something less urgent than a fractured skull or an accident with one of the power tools or some sort of convulsion. A serious case of the flu, pneumonia, a broken arm, even appendicitis. Any of those things would have left enough time. I suspect that what happened came as a result of too much cheap whiskey, of which Grady had laid in a generous supply, unbeknownst to me, and a curious condition which the old-timers call cabin fever. Do you know the term?
Ullman offered a patronizing little smile, ready to explain as soon as Jack admitted his ignorance, and Jack was happy to respond quickly and crisply.
It's a slang term for the claustrophobic reaction that can occur when people are shut in together over long periods of time. The feeling of claustrophobia is externalized as dislike for the people you happen to be shut in with. In extreme cases, it can result in hallucinations and violence. Murder has been done over such minor things as a burned meal or an argument about whose turn it is to do the dishes.
Ullman looked rather nonplussed, which did Jack a world of good. He decided to press a little further, but silently promised Wendy he would stay cool.
I suspect you did make a mistake at that. Did he hurt them?
He killed them, Mr. Torrance, and then committed suicide. He murdered the little girls with a hatchet, his wife with a shotgun, and himself the same way. His leg was broken, undoubtedly so drunk he fell downstairs.
Ullman spread his hands and looked at Jack self-righteously.
Was he a high school graduate?
As a matter of fact, he wasn't, Ullman said a little stiffly.
I thought a, shall we say, less imaginative individual would be less susceptible to the rigors, the loneliness.
That was your mistake, Jack said.
A stupid man is more prone to cabin fever, just as he's more prone to shoot somebody over a card game or commit a spur-of-the-moment robbery. He gets bored. When the snow comes, there's nothing to do but watch TV or play solitaire and cheat when he can't get all the aces out. Nothing to do but bitch at his wife and nag at the kids and drink. It gets hard to sleep because there's nothing to hear. So he drinks himself to sleep and wakes up with a hangover. He gets edgy. And maybe the telephone goes out and the TV aerial blows down and there's nothing to do but think and cheat at solitaire and get edgier and edgier. Finally, boom, boom, boom.
Whereas a more educated man, such as yourself...
Well, my wife and I both like to read. I have a play to work on, as Al Shockley probably told you. Danny has his puzzles, his coloring books, and his crystal radio. I plan to teach him to read. And I also want to teach him to snowshoe. Wendy would like to learn how, too. Oh, yes, I think we can keep busy and out of each other's hair if the TV goes on the fritz.
He paused.
And Al was telling the truth when he told you I no longer drink. I did once, and it got to be serious. But I haven't had so much as a glass of beer in the last 14 months. I don't intend to bring any alcohol up here, and I don't think there will be an opportunity to get any after the snow flies.
In that, you would be quite correct, Ullman said. But as long as the three of you are up here, the potential for problems is multiplied. I have told Mr. Shockley this, and he told me he would take the responsibility. Now I've told you. And apparently you are also willing to take the responsibility.
I am.
All right. I'll accept that, since I have little choice. But I would still rather have an unattached college boy taking a year off. Well, perhaps you'll do. And now I'll turn you over to Mr. Watson, who will take you through the basement and around the ground. Unless you have any further questions?
No, none at all.
Ullman stood.
I hope there are no hard feelings, Mr. Torrance. There is nothing personal in the things I have said to you. I only want what's best for the Overlook. It's a great hotel. I want it to stay that way.
No. No hard feelings.
Jack flashed the PR grin again, but he was glad Ullman didn't offer to shake hands. There were hard feelings. All kinds of them. Chapter 2. Boulder. She looked out the kitchen window and saw him just sitting there on the curb, not playing with his trucks or the wagon or even the balsa glider that had pleased him so much all the last week since Jack had brought it home. He was just sitting there, watching for their shop-worn VW, his elbows planted on his thighs and his chin propped in his hands, a 5-year-old kid waiting for his daddy. Wendy suddenly felt bad, almost crying bad. She hung the dish towel over the bar by the sink and went downstairs, buttoning the top two buttons of her house dress. Jack and his pride.
Hey, Noel, I don't need an advance. I'm okay for a while.
The hallway walls were gouged and marked with crayons, grease pencils, spray paint. The stairs were steep and splintery. The whole building smelled of sour age. And what sort of place was this for Danny after the small, neat brick house in Stovington? The people living above them on the third floor weren't married, and while that didn't bother her, their constant rancorous fighting did. It scared her. The guy up there was Tom, and after the bars had closed and they had returned home, the fights would start in earnest. The rest of the week was just a prelim in comparison. The Friday night fight, Jack called them, but it wasn't funny. The woman, her name was Elaine, would at last be reduced to tears and to repeating over and over again, "Don't, Tom, please don't, please don't." And he would shout at her. Once they had even awakened Danny, and Danny slept like a corpse. The next morning, Jack caught Tom going out and had spoken to him on the sidewalk at some length. Tom started to bluster, and Jack had said something else to him, too quietly for Wendy to hear, and Tom had only shaken his head sullenly and walked away. That had been a week ago, and for a few days things had been better, but since the weekend things had been working back to normal, excuse me, abnormal. It was bad for the boy. Her sense of grief washed over her again, but she was on the walk now, and she smothered it. Sweeping a dress under her and sitting down on the curb beside him, she said, "What's up, Dot?" He smiled at her, but it was perfunctory. "Hi, Mom." The glider was between his sneakered feet, and she saw that one of the wings had started to splinter. "Want me to see what I can do with that, honey?" Danny had gone back to staring up the street. "No, Dad will fix it." "Your daddy may not be back until supper time, Doc. It's a long drive up into those mountains." "Do you think the bug will break down?"
"No, I don't think so."
But he had just given her something new to worry about. "Thanks, Danny, I needed that."
"Dad said it might," Danny said in a matter-of-fact, almost bored manner. "He said the fuel pump was all shot to shit."
"Don't say that, Danny."
"Fuel pump?"
he asked her with honest surprise. She sighed.
"No,
all shot to shit. Don't say that."
"Why?"
"It's vulgar."
"What's vulgar, Mom?"
"Like when you pick your nose at the table or pee with the bathroom door open, or saying things like all shot to shit. Shit is a vulgar word. Nice people don't say it."
"Dad says it. When he was looking at the bug motor, he said, 'Christ, this fuel pump's all shot to shit.' Isn't Dad nice?"
"How do you get into these things, Winifred? Do you practice?" "He's nice, but he's also a grown-up. And he's very careful not to say things like that in front of people who wouldn't understand."
"You mean like Uncle Al?"
"Yes, that's right."
"Can I say it when I'm grown up?"
"I suppose you will, whether I like it or not."
"How old?"
"How does 20 sound, Doc?"
"That's a long time to have to wait."
"I guess it is, but will you try?"
"Okay."
He went back to staring up the street. He flexed a little, as if to rise,
but the beetle coming was much newer and much brighter red. He relaxed again. She wondered just how hard this move to Colorado had been on Danny. He was close-mouthed about it, but it bothered her to see him spending so much time by himself. In Vermont, three of Jack's fellow faculty members had had children about Danny's age, and there had been the preschool, but in this neighborhood, there was no one for him to play with. Most of the apartments were occupied by students attending CU, and of the few married couples here on Arapaho Street, only a tiny percentage had children. She had spotted perhaps a dozen of high school or junior high school age, three infants, and that was all.
"Mommy, why did Daddy lose his job?"
She was jolted out of her reverie and floundering for an answer. She and Jack had discussed ways they might handle just such a question from Danny, ways that had varied from evasion to the plain truth with no varnish on it. But Danny had never asked, not until now, when she was feeling low and least prepared for such a question. Yet he was looking at her, maybe reading the confusion on her face and forming his own ideas about that. She thought that to children, adult motives and actions must seem as bulking and ominous as dangerous animals seen in the shadows of a dark forest. They were jerked about like puppets, having only the vaguest notions why. The thought brought her dangerously close to tears again, and while she fought them off, she leaned over, picked up the disabled glider, and turned it over in her hands.
"Your daddy was coaching the debate team, Danny. Do you remember that?"
"Sure," he said.
"Arguments for fun, right?"
"Right." She turned the glider over and over, looking at the trade name, the Speedo Glide, and the blue star decals on the wings, and found herself telling the exact truth to her son.
"Well, there was a boy named George Hatfield that Daddy had to cut from the team. Now, that means he wasn't as good as some of the others. George said your daddy cut him because he didn't like him, and not because he wasn't good enough. But then George did a bad thing. I think you know about that."
"Was he the one who put holes in our bug's tires?"
"Yes, he was. It was after school, and your daddy caught him doing it." Now she hesitated again, but there was no question of evasion now. It was reduced to tell the truth or tell a lie. "Well, your daddy, sometimes he does things he's sorry for later. Sometimes he doesn't think the way he should. Well, that doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it does."
"Did he hurt George Hatfield like the time I spilled all his papers?"
"Sometimes," Danny, with his arm in a cast, "he does things he's sorry for later." Wendy blinked her eyes savagely hard, driving her tears all the way back.
"Something like that, honey. Your daddy hit George to make him stop cutting the tires, and George hit his head. But then the men who were in charge of the school said that George couldn't go there anymore, and your daddy couldn't teach there anymore."
She stopped, out of words, and waited in dread for the deluge of questions.
"Oh," Danny said, and went back to looking up the street. Apparently the subject was closed. If only it could be closed that easily for her.
She stood up.
"I'm going upstairs for a cup of tea, Doc. Want a couple of cookies and a glass of milk?"
"I think I'll watch for Dad."
"I don't think he'll be home much before 5.
"Maybe he'll be early."
"Maybe," she agreed. "Maybe he will."
She was halfway up the walk when he called,
"Mommy?"
"What, Danny?"
"Do you want to go and live in that hotel for the winter?"
Now, which of the 5,000 answers should she give to that one? The way she had felt yesterday, or last night, or this morning? They were all different. They crossed the spectrum from rosy pink to dead black. She said,
"If it's what your father wants, it's what I want."
She paused.
"What about you?"
"I guess I do," he said finally. "Nobody much to play with around here."
"You miss your friends, don't you?"
"Sometimes I miss Scott and Andy. That's about all."
She went back to him and kissed him, rumpled his light-colored hair that was just losing its baby fineness. He was such a solemn little boy, and sometimes she wondered just how he was supposed to survive with her and Jack for parents. The high hopes they had begun with came down to this unpleasant apartment building in a city they didn't know. The image of Danny and his cast rose up before her again. Somebody in the Divine Placement Service had made a mistake, one she sometimes feared could never be corrected, and which only the most innocent bystander could pay for. Stay out of the road, Doc, she said, and hugged him tight.
Sure, Mom.
She went upstairs and into the kitchen. She put on the teapot and laid a couple of Oreos on a plate for Danny in case he decided to come up while she was lying down. Sitting at the table, with her big pottery cup in front of her, she looked out the window at him, still sitting on the curb in his blue jeans and his oversized dark green Stubbington Prep sweatshirt, the glider now lying beside him. The tears, which had threatened all day, now came in a cloudburst, and she leaned into the fragrant, curling steam of the tea and wept, in grief and loss for the past and terror of the future. Chapter 3. Watson.
You lost your temper, Ullman had said.
Okay, here's your furnace, Watson said, turning on a light in the dark, musty-smelling room. He was a beefy man with fluffy popcorn hair, white shirt, and dark green chinos. He swung open a small square grating in the furnace's belly, and he and Jack peered in together.
This here's the pilot light.
A steady blue-white jet hissing, steadily upward, channeled destructive force. But the key word, Jack thought, was destructive and not channeled. If you stuck your hand in there, the barbecue would happen in 3 quick seconds.
Lost your temper. Danny, are you all right?
The furnace filled the entire room, by far the biggest and oldest Jack had ever seen.
The pilot's got a fail-safe, Watson told him. Little sensor in there measures heat. If the heat falls below a certain point, it sets off a buzzer in your quarters. Boiler's on the other side of the wall. I'll take you around.
He slammed the grating shut and led Jack behind the iron bulk of the furnace toward another door. The iron radiated a stuporous heat at them, and for some reason Jack thought of a large dozing cat. Watson jingled his keys and whistled.
Lost your...
When he went back into his study and saw Danny standing there, wearing nothing but his training pants and a grin, a slow red cloud of rage had eclipsed Jack's reason. It had seemed slow subjectively inside his head, but it must have all happened in less than a minute. It only seemed slow the way some dreams seem slow, the bad ones. Every door and drawer in his study seemed to have been ransacked in the time he had been gone. Closet, cupboards, the sliding bookcase, every desk drawer yanked out to the top. His manuscript, the three-act play he had been slowly developing from a novelette he had written 7 years ago as an undergraduate, was scattered all over the floor. He had been drinking a beer and doing the Act 2 corrections when Wendy said the phone was for him, and Danny had poured the can of beer all over the pages, probably to see it foam. See it foam, see it foam. The words played over and over in his mind like a single sick chord on an out-of-tune piano, completing the circuit of his rage. He stepped deliberately toward his 3-year-old son, who was looking up at him with that pleased grin, his pleasure at the job of work so successfully and recently completed in Daddy's study. Danny began to say something, and that was when he had grabbed Danny's hand and bent it to make him drop the typewriter eraser and the mechanical pencil he was clenching in it. Danny had cried out a little, "No, no, tell the truth." He screamed. It was all hard to remember through the fog of anger, the sick single thump of that one Spike Jones chord. Wendy, somewhere, asking what was wrong. Her voice faint, damped by the inner mist. This was between the two of them. He had whirled Danny around to spank him, his big adult fingers digging into the scant meat of the boy's forearm, meeting around it in a closed fist, and the snap of the breaking bone had not been loud, not loud, but it had been very loud, huge, but not loud. Just enough of a sound to slit through the red fog like an arrow. But instead of letting in sunlight, that sound let in the dark clouds of shame and remorse, the terror, the agonizing convulsion of the spirit. A clean sound, with the past on one side of it and all the future on the other. A sound like a breaking pencil lead or a small piece of kindling when you brought it down over your knee. A moment of utter silence on the other side, in respect to the beginning, future maybe, all the rest of his life. Seeing Danny's face drain of color until it was like cheese, seeing his eyes, always large, grow larger still and glassy. Jack, sure the boy was going to faint dead away into the puddle of beer and papers. His own voice, weak and drunk, slurry, trying to take it all back, to find a way around that not-too-loud sound of bone cracking and into the past. Is there a status quo in the house? Saying, "Danny, are you all right?" Danny's answering shriek. Then Wendy's shocked gasped as she came around to them and saw the peculiar angle Danny's forearm had to his elbow. No arm was meant to hang quite that way in a world of normal families. Her own scream as she swept him into her arms in a nonsense babble, "Oh, God, Danny, oh, dear God, oh, sweet God, your poor sweet arm." And Jack was standing there, stunned and stupid, trying to understand how a thing like this could have happened. He was standing there, and his eyes met the eyes of his wife, and he saw that Wendy hated him. It did not occur to him what the hate might mean in practical terms. It was only later that he realized she might have left him that night, gone to a motel, gotten a divorce lawyer in the morning, or called the police. He saw only that his wife hated him, and he felt staggered by it, all alone. He felt awful. This was what oncoming death felt like. Then she fled for the telephone and dialed the hospital with their screaming boy wedged in the crook of her arm, and Jack did not go after her. He only stood in the ruins of his office, smelling beer and thinking. "You lost your temper." He rubbed his hand harshly across his lips and followed Watson into the boiler room. It was humid in here, but it was more than the humidity that brought the sick and slimy sweat onto his brow and stomach and legs. The remembering did that. It was a total thing that made that night 2 years ago seem like 2 hours ago. There was no lag. It brought the shame and revulsion back, the sense of having no worth at all. And that feeling always made him want to have a drink. And the wanting of a drink brought still blacker despair. Would he ever have an hour, not a week or even a day, mind you, but just one waking hour when the craving for a drink wouldn't surprise him like this? "The boiler," Watson announced. He pulled a red and blue bandana from his back pocket, blew his nose with a decisive honk, and thrust it back out of sight after a short peek into it to see if he had gotten anything interesting. The boiler stood on four cement blocks, a long and cylindrical metal tank, copper-jacketed and often patched. It squatted beneath a confusion of pipes and ducts, which zigzagged upward into the high, cobweb-festooned basement ceiling. To Jack's right, two large heating pipes came through the wall from the furnace in the adjoining room. "Pressure gauge is here," Watson tapped it. "Pounds per square inch, PSI, I guess you'd know that. I got her up to 100 now, and the rooms get a little chilly at night. Few guests complain, what the fuck. They're crazy to come up here in September anyway. Besides, this is an old baby. Got more patches on her than a pair of welfare overalls." Out came the bandana. A honk, a peek, back it went. "They got me a fucking cold," Watson said conversationally. "I get one every September. I'd be tinkering around down here with this old whore, and then I'd be out cutting the grass or raking that rope court. Get a chill and catch a cold, my old mum used to say. God bless her, she's been dead 6 years. The cancer got her. Once the cancer gets you, you might as well make your will. But you'll want to keep your press up to no more than 50, maybe 60. Mr. Roman, he says to heat the west wing one day, central wing the next, east wing the day after that. Ain't he a crazy man? I hate that little fucker. Yap, 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 all the livelong day. He's just like one of those little dogs that bites you on the ankle, then run around and pee all over the rug. If brains was black powder, he couldn't blow his own nose. It's a pity these things you see when you ain't got a gun. Oh, look here. You open and close these ducts by pulling these rings. I got them all marked for you. The blue tags all go to the rooms in the east wing. Red tags is the middle. Yellow is the west wing. When you go to heat the west wing, you got to remember that's the side of the hotel that really catches the weather. When it whoops, these rooms get as cold as a frigid woman with an ice cube up her works. You can run your press all the way to 80 on west wing days. I would anyway. The thermostat's upstairs, Jack began. Watson shook his head vehemently, making his fluffy hair bounce on his skull. They ain't hooked up. They're just there for show. Some of these people from California, they don't think things is right unless they got it hot enough to grow a palm tree in their fucking bedroom. All the heat comes from down here. Gotta watch the press, though. See a creep? He tapped the main dial, which had crept from 100 pounds per square inch to 102, as Watson soliloquized. Jack felt a sudden shiver across his back in a hurry and thought, the goose just walked over my grave. Then Watson gave the pressure wheel a spin and dumped the boiler off. There was a great hissing, and the needle dropped back to 91. Watson twisted the valve shut, and the hissing died reluctantly. She creeps, Watson said. You tell that fat little peckerwood omen
He drags out the account books and spends 3 hours showing how he can't afford a new one till 1982. I tell you, this whole place is going to go sky high someday, and I just hope that fat fuck's here to ride the rocket. God, I wish I could be as charitable as my mother was. She could see the good in everyone. Me, I'm just as mean as a snake with the shingles. Well, what the fuck? A man can't help his nature. Now, you gotta remember to come down here twice a day and once at night before you rack in. You gotta check the press. If you forget, it'll just creep and creep, and like as not, you and your family will wake up on the fucking moon. You just dump her off a little and you'll have no trouble. What's the top end? Oh, she's ready for 250, but she'd blow long before that now. You couldn't get me to come down and stand next to her when that dial was up to 180.
There's no automatic shutdown?
No, there ain't. This was built before such things were required. Federal government's into everything these days, ain't it? FBI opening mail, CIA bugging the goddamn phones, and look what happened to that Nixon. Wasn't that a sorry sight? But if you just come down here regular and check the press, you'll be fine. And remember to switch those ducks around like he wants. Won't none of them rooms get much above 45 unless we have an amazing warm winter. And you'll have your own apartment just as warm as you like it.
And what about the plumbing?
Okay, I was just getting to that. Over here, through this arch.
They walked into a long rectangular room that seemed to stretch for miles. Watson pulled a cord, and a single 75-watt bulb cast a sickish swinging glow over the area where they were standing. Straight ahead was the bottom of the elevator shaft, heavy greased cables descending to pulleys 20 feet in diameter, and a huge grease-clogged motor. Newspapers were everywhere, bundled and banded and boxed. Other cartons were marked records or invoices or receipts save. The smell was yellow and moldy. Some of the cartons were falling apart, spilling yellow flimsy sheets that might have been 20 years old out onto the floor. Jack stared around, fascinated. The Overlook's entire history might be here, buried in those rotting cartons.
That elevator's a bitch to keep running, Watson said, jerking his thumb at it. I know Ullman's buying the state elevator inspector a few fancy dinners to keep the repairman away from that fucker. Now, here's your central plumbing core.
In front of them, five large pipes, each of them wrapped in insulation and cinched with steel bands, rose into the shadows and out of sight. Watson pointed to a cobwebby shelf beside the utility shaft. There were a number of greasy rags on it and a loose-leaf binder.
Now, that there is all your plumbing schematics, he said. I don't think you'll have any trouble with leaks. Never have been. But sometimes the pipes freeze up. Only way to stop that is to run the faucets a little bit during the night. But there's over 400 taps in this fucking palace. That fat fairy upstairs would scream all the way to Denver when he saw the water bill. Ain't that right?
I'd say that's a remarkably astute analysis.
Watson looked at him admiringly.
Say, you really are a college fella, aren't you? Talk just like a book. I admire that. As long as the fella ain't one of those fairy boys. Lots of them are. You know who stirred up all those college riots a few years ago? The homosexuals, that's who. They get frustrated and have to cut loose. Coming out of the closet, they call it. Holy shit, I don't know what the world's coming to. Now, if she freezes, she's most likely going to freeze right up in this shaft. No heat, you see. If it happens, use this.
He reached into a broken orange crate and produced a small gas torch.
You just unstrap the insulation when you find the ice plug and put the heat right to it. Get it?
Yes, but what if a pipe freezes outside the utility core?
And that won't happen if you're doing your job and keeping the place heated. You can't get to the other pipes anyway. Don't you fret about it. You'll have no trouble. Beastly place down here. Cobwebby. Gives me the horrors it does.
Ullman said the first winter caretaker killed his family and himself.
Yeah, that guy Grady. He was a bad actor. I knew that the minute I saw him. Always grinning like an egg-sucked dog. That was when they were just starting out here, and that fat fuck Ullman, he would have hired the Boston Strangler if he'd have worked for minimum wage.
It was a ranger from the National Park that found him. The phone was out. All of them up in the west wing on the third floor. Froze solid. Too bad about the little girls. 8 and 6 they was. Cute as cut buttons. Oh, that was a hell of a mess.
That Ullman. He manages some honky-tonky resort place down in Florida in the off-season. And he caught a plane up to Denver and hired a sleigh to take him up here from Sidewinder because the roads were closed. A sleigh! Can you believe that? He about split a gut trying to keep it out of the papers. Did pretty well, I gotta give him that. There was an item in the Denver Post, and of course the Bitchery and that pissant little rag they have down in Estes Park, but that was about all. Pretty good, considering the reputation this place has got. I expected some reporter would dig it all up again and just sort of put Grady in it as an excuse to rake over the scandals. What scandals? Watson shrugged. Many big hotels have got scandals, he said. Just like every big hotel's got a ghost. Why? Hell, people come and go. Sometimes one of them will pop off in his room, heart attack or stroke or something like that. Hotels are superstitious places. No 13th floor or room 13. No mirrors on the back of the door you just come into. Stuff like that. Well, we lost a lady just this last July. Omen had to take care of that, and you can bet your ass he did. That's what they pay him $22,000 a season for. And as much as I dislike a little prick, he earns it. It's like some people just come up here to throw up, and they hire a guy like Omen to clean up the messes. Now, here's this woman. Must be 60 fucking years old, my age. And her hair's dyed just as red as a whore's stoplight. Tits sagging just about down to her belly button on account of she ain't wearing no brassiere. Big, very coarse veins all up and down her legs so they look like a couple of goddamn road maps. The jewels dripping off her neck and arms hanging out her ears. And she's got this kid with her. Now, he can't be no more than 17. With hair down to his asshole and his crotch bulging like he stuffed it up with the funny pages. So, they're here a week, 10 days maybe, and every night it's the same drill. Down in the Colorado Lounge from 5 to 7, her sucking up Singapore slings like they're going to outlaw them tomorrow, and him with just the one bottle of Olympia, sucking it, making it last. And she'd be making jokes and saying all these witty things. And every time she said one, he'd grin just like a fucking ape, like she had strings tied to the corners of his mouth. Only after a few days, you could see it was getting harder and harder for him to grin. And God knows what he had to think about to get his pump primed by bedtime. Well, they go in for dinner, him walking and her staggering, drunk as a cooch, you know. And he'd be pinching the waitresses and grinning at him when she wasn't looking. Hell, we even had bets on how long he'd last. Watson shrugged. And then he comes down one night around 10, saying his wife is indisposed, which meant she was passed out again like every other night they was there. And he's going to get her some stomach medicine. So off he goes in the little Porsche they come in, and that's the last we see of him. The next morning, she comes down and tries to put on this big act. But all day she's getting paler and paler, and Mr. Roman asks her, sort of diplomatic-like, would she like him to notify the state cops, just in case he had a little accident or something. Well, she's on him like a cat. No, no, no. He's a fine driver. She isn't worried. Everything's under control. He'll be back for dinner. So, that afternoon, she steps into the Colorado around 3 and never has no dinner at all. She goes up to her room around 10:30, and that's the last time anybody ever saw her alive. What happened? County coroner said she took about 30 sleeping pills on top of all the booze. Her husband showed up the next day, some big-shot lawyer from New York. He gave old Omen 4 different shades of holy hell. And I'll sue this and I'll sue that, and when I'm through, you won't even be able to find a clean pair of underwear. And stuff like that. But Omen's good, the sucker. Omen got him quieted down. Probably asked that big shot how he'd like to see his wife splashed all over the New York papers. Wife of prominent New York blah blah found dead with belly full of sleeping pills. After playing hide the salami with a kid young enough to be a grandson. Now, the state cops found a Porsche in the back of this all-night burger joint down in Lyons, and Ullman pulled a few strings to get it released to that lawyer. Then both of them ganged up on old Archer Houghton, which is the county coroner, and got him to change the verdict to accidental death. Heart attack. Now, old Archer's driving a Chrysler. I don't begrudge him. The man's got to take it where he finds it, especially when he starts getting along in years. Out came the bandana, honk, peek, out of sight. So, what happens? About a week later, this stupid cunt of a chambermaid, Dolores Vickery by name, she gives out with a hell of a shriek while she's making up the room where those two stayed, and she faints dead away. When she comes to, she says she's seen the dead woman in the bathroom, lying naked in the tub. Her face was all purple and puffy, she says, and she was grinning at me. So, a woman gave her 2 weeks' worth of walking papers and told her to get lost. I figure there's maybe 40, 50 people died in this hotel since my grandfather opened it for business in 1910. He looked shrewdly at Jack. You know how most of them go?
heart attack or stroke while they're banging the lady they're with. That's what these resorts get a lot of. Old types that want one last fling. They come up here to the mountains to pretend they're 20 again. Sometimes something gives, and not all the guys who ran this place was as good as Ullman is at keeping it out of the papers. So the Overlook got a reputation, yeah. I bet the fucking Biltmore in New York City's got a reputation if you ask the right people.
But no ghosts.
Mr. Torrance, I worked here all my life. I played here when I was a kid no older than your boy in that wallet snapshot you showed me. I never seen a ghost yet. You want to come out back with me? I'll show you the equipment shed.
Fine.
As Watson reached up to turn off the light, Jack said, "There sure are a lot of papers down here."
Oh, you're not kidding. Seems like they go back 1,000 years. Newspapers and old invoices and bills of lading and Christ knows what else. My dad used to keep up with them pretty good when we had the old wood-burning furnace, but now they got all out of hand. Some year I gotta get a boy to haul him down to Sidewinder and burn him. If Ullman will stand the expense. And I guess he will if I holler rat loud enough.
Then there are rats?
Yeah, I guess there's some. I got the traps and the poison Mr. Ullman wants you to use up in the attic and down here. You keep a good eye on your boy, Mr. Torrance. You wouldn't want nothing to happen to him.
No, I sure wouldn't.
Coming from Watson, the advice didn't sting. They went to the stairs and paused there for a moment while Watson blew his nose again.
You'll find all the tools you need out there and some you don't, I guess. And there's the shingles. Did Ullman tell you about that?
Yes, he wants part of the west roof reshingled.
He'll get all the for free out of you that he can, the fat little prick, then whine around in the spring about how you didn't do the job half right. I told him once, right to his face, I said...
Watson's words faded away to a comforting drone as they mounted the stairs. Jack Torrance looked back over his shoulder once into the impenetrable, musty-smelling darkness and thought that if there ever was a place that should have ghosts, this was it. He thought of Grady, locked in by the soft, implacable snow, going quietly berserk and committing his atrocity. Did they scream, he wondered. Poor Grady, feeling it close in on him more every day, and knowing at last that for him, spring would never come. He shouldn't have been here, and he shouldn't have lost his temper. As he followed Watson through the door, the words echoed back to him like a knell, accompanied by a sharp snap, like a breaking pencil lead. Dear God, he could use a drink. Or 1,000 of them. Chapter 4. Shadowland. Danny weakened and went up for his milk and cookies at 4:15. He gobbled them while looking out the window, then went in to kiss his mother, who was lying down. She suggested that he stay in and watch Sesame Street. The time would pass faster. But he shook his head firmly and went back to his place on the curb. Now it was 5:00, and although he didn't have a watch and couldn't tell time too well yet anyway, he was aware of passing time by the lengthening of the shadows and by the golden cast that now tinged the afternoon light. Turning the glider over in his hands, he sang under his breath, "Skip to my loon, I don't care, skip to my loon, I don't care, my master's gone away, loo-loo, skip to my loon." They had sung that song all together at the Jack and Jill nursery school he had gone back to in Stubbington. He didn't go to nursery school out here because Daddy couldn't afford to send him anymore. He knew his mother and father worried about that, worried that it was adding to his loneliness, and even more deeply, unspoken between them, that Danny blamed them. But he didn't really want to go to that old Jack and Jill anymore. It was for babies. He wasn't quite a big kid yet, but he wasn't a baby anymore. Big kids went to the big school and got a hot lunch. First grade. Next year. This year was someplace between being a baby and a real kid. He was all right. He did miss Scott and Andy, mostly Scott, but it was still all right. It seemed best to wait alone for whatever might happen next. He understood a great many things about his parents, and he knew that many times they didn't like his understandings, and many other times refused to believe them, but someday they would have to believe. He was content to wait. It was too bad they couldn't believe more, though, especially at times like now. Mommy was lying on her bed in the apartment, just about crying. She was so worried about Daddy. Some of the things she was worried about were too grown up for Danny to understand. Vague things that had to do with security, with Daddy's self-image, feelings of guilt and anger, and the fear of what was to become of them. But the two main things on her mind right now were that Daddy had had a breakdown in the mountains,
Then why doesn't he call? Or that Daddy had gone off to do the bad thing. Danny knew perfectly well what the bad thing was, since Scotty Aronson, who was 6 months older, had explained it to him. Scotty knew because his daddy did the bad thing, too. Once, Scotty told him, his daddy had punched his mom right in the eye and knocked her down. Finally, Scotty's dad and mom had gotten a divorce over the bad thing. And when Danny had known him, Scotty lived with his mother and only saw his daddy on weekends. The greatest terror of Danny's life was divorce, a word that appeared always in his mind as a sign painted in red letters which were covered with hissing, poisonous snakes. In divorce, your parents no longer live together. They had a tug of war over you in a court. Tennis court? Badminton court? Danny wasn't sure which, or if it was some other, but Mommy and Daddy had played both tennis and badminton at Stubbington, so he assumed it could be either. And you had to go with one of them, and you practically never saw the other one, and the one you were with could marry somebody you didn't even know if the urge came on them. The most terrifying thing about divorce was that he had sensed the word, or concept, or whatever it was that came to him in his understandings, floating around in his own parents' heads, sometimes diffuse and relatively distant, sometimes as thick and obscuring and frightening as thunderheads. It had been that way after Danny punished him for messing the papers up in his study and the doctor had to put his arm in the cast. That memory was already faded, but the memory of the divorce thoughts was clear and terrifying. It had mostly been around his mommy that time, and he had been in constant terror that she would pluck the word from her brain and drag it out of her mouth, making it real. Divorce. It was a constant undercurrent in their thoughts, one of the few he could always pick up, like the beat of simple music. But like a beat, the central thought formed only the spine of more complex thoughts, thoughts he could not as yet even begin to interpret. They came to him only as colors and moods. Mommy's divorce thoughts centered around what Daddy had done to his arm, and what had happened at Stubbington when Daddy lost his job. That boy, that George Hatfield, who got pissed off at Daddy and put the holes in their bug's feet. Daddy's divorce thoughts were more complex, colored dark violet and shot through with frightening veins of pure black. He seemed to think they would be better off if he left, that things would stop hurting. His daddy heard almost all the time, mostly about the bad thing. Danny could almost always pick that up, too. Daddy's constant craving to go to a dark place and watch a color TV and eat peanuts out of a bowl and do the bad thing until his brain would be quiet and leave him alone. But this afternoon, his mother had no need to worry, and he wished he could go and tell her that. The bug had not broken down. Daddy was not off somewhere doing the bad thing. He was almost home now, putting along the highway between Lyons and Boulder. For the moment, his daddy wasn't even thinking about the bad thing. He was thinking about... Danny looked furtively behind him at the kitchen window. Sometimes, thinking very hard made something happen to him. It made things, real things, go away. And then he saw things that weren't there. Once, not long after they put the cast on his arm, this had happened at the supper table. They weren't talking much to each other then, but they were thinking, oh yes, the thoughts of divorce hung over the kitchen table like a cloud full of black rain, pregnant, ready to burst. It was so bad he couldn't eat. The thought of eating with all that black divorce around made him want to throw up. And because it had seemed desperately important, he had thrown himself fully into concentration, and something had happened. When he came back to real things, he was lying on the floor with beans and mashed potatoes in his lap, and his mommy was holding him and crying, and Daddy had been on the phone. He had been frightened, had tried to explain to them that there was nothing wrong, that this sometimes happened to him when he concentrated on understanding more than what normally came to him. He tried to explain about Tony, who they called his invisible playmate. His father had said, he's having a hallucination. He seems okay, but I want the doctor to look at him anyway. Now, after the doctor left, Mommy had made him promise to never do that again, to never scare them that way. And Danny had agreed. He was frightened himself, because when he had concentrated his mind, it had flown out to his daddy. And for just a moment, before Tony had appeared, far away, as he always did, calling distantly, and the strange things had blotted out their kitchen and the carved roast on the blue plate, for just a moment, his own consciousness had plunged through his daddy's darkness to an incomprehensible word much more frightening than divorce. And that word was suicide. Danny had never come across it again in his daddy's mind, and he had certainly not gone looking for it. He didn't care if he never found out exactly what that word meant. But he did like to concentrate, because sometimes Tony would come. Not every time. Sometimes things just got woozy and swimmy for a minute and then cleared. Most times, in fact. But at other times, Tony would appear at the very limit of his vision, calling distantly and beckoning. It had happened twice since they moved to Boulder, and he remembered how surprised and pleased he had been to find Tony had followed him all the way from Vermont. So all his friends hadn't been left behind after all. The first time, he had been out in the backyard, and nothing much had happened, just Tony beckoning, and then darkness, and a few minutes later, he had come back to real things with a few vague fragments of memory, like a jumbled dream. The second time, 2 weeks ago, had been more interesting. Tony, beckoning, calling from 4 yards over, "Danny, come see." It seemed that he was getting up, then falling into a deep hole, like Alice into Wonderland. Then he had been in the basement of the apartment house, and Tony had been beside him, pointing into the shadows of the trunk his daddy carried all his important papers in, especially the play. "See," Tony had said in his distant musical voice, "it's under the stairs, right under the stairs. The movers put it right under the stairs." Danny had stepped forward to look more closely at this marvel, and then he was falling again, this time out of the backyard swing where he had been sitting all along. He had gotten the wind knocked out of himself, too. And 3 or 4 days later, his daddy had been stomping around, telling Mommy furiously that he had been all over the goddamn basement and the trunk wasn't there, and he was going to sue the goddamn movers who had left it somewhere between Vermont and Colorado. How is he supposed to be able to finish the play if things like this kept cropping up? Well, Danny said, "No, Daddy, it's under the stairs. The movers put it right under the stairs." Daddy had given him a strange look and had gone down to see. The trunk had been there, just where Tony had showed him. Daddy had taken him aside, had sat him on his lap, and had asked Danny who let him down the cellar. Had it been Tom from upstairs? The cellar was dangerous, Daddy said. That was why the landlord kept it locked. If someone was leaving it unlocked, Daddy wanted to know. He was glad to have his papers and his play, but it wouldn't be worth it to him, he said, if Danny fell down the stairs and broke his leg. Danny told his father earnestly that he hadn't been down in the cellar, that the door was always locked, and Mommy agreed. Danny never went down in the back hall, she said, because it was damp and dark and spidery, and he didn't tell lies. "Well, then how did you know, Doc?" Daddy asked. "Tony showed me." His mother and father had exchanged a look over his head. This had happened before, from time to time. Because it was frightening, they swept it quickly from their minds. But he knew they worried about Tony, Mommy especially. And he was careful about thinking the way that could make Tony come when she might see. But now he thought she was lying down, not moving about in the kitchen yet, and so he concentrated hard to see if he could understand what Daddy was thinking about. His brow furrowed, and his slightly grimy hands clenched into tight fists on his jeans. He did not close his eyes, that wasn't necessary, but he squinched them down to slits and imagined Daddy's voice, Jack's voice, John Daniel Torrance's voice, deep and steady, sometimes quirking up with amusement or deepening even more with anger, or just staying steady because he was thinking. Thinking of. Thinking about. Thinking. Thinking. Danny sighed quietly, and his body slumped on the curb as if all the muscles had gone out of it. He was fully conscious. He saw the street and the girl and boy walking up the sidewalk on the other side, holding hands because they were in love? So happy about the day and themselves together in the day. He saw autumn leaves blowing along the gutter, yellow cartwheels of irregular shape. He saw the house they were passing and noticed how the roof was covered with shingles. "I guess it'll be no problem if the flashing's okay. Yeah, that'll be all right, that Watson Christ. What a character. Wish there was a place for him in the play. I'll end up with the whole fucking human race in it if I don't watch out." "Yeah, shingles. Are there nails out there?" "Oh, shit, forgot to ask." "Well, they're simple to get. Sidewinder hardware store. Wasps. They're nesting this time of year. I might want to get one of those bug bombs in case they're there when I rip up the old shingles. New shingles. Old shingles." So, that's what he was thinking about. He had gotten the job and was thinking about shingles. Danny didn't know who Watson was, but everything else seemed clear enough. And he might get to see a wasp's nest, just as sure as his name was
Danny! Danny!
He looked up, and there was Tony, far up the street, standing by a stop sign and waving. Danny, as always, felt a warm burst of pleasure at seeing his old friend, but this time he seemed to feel a prick of fear, too, as if Tony had come with some darkness hidden behind his back, a jar of wasps, which, when released, would sting deeply. But there was no question of not going. He slumped further down on the curb, his hands sliding laxly from his thighs and dangling below the fork of his crotch. His chin sank onto his chest. Then there was a dim, painless tug as part of him got up and ran after Tony into funneling darkness.
Danny!
Now the darkness was shot with swirling whiteness, a coughing, whooping sound and bending, tortured shadows that resolved themselves into fir trees at night, being pushed by a screaming gale. Snow swirled and danced, snow everywhere. "Too deep," Tony said from the darkness, and there was a sadness in his voice that terrified Danny.
"Too deep to get out."
Another shape, looming, rearing, huge and rectangular, a sloping roof, whiteness that was blurred in the stormy darkness, many windows, a long building with a shingled roof. Some of the shingles were greener, newer. His daddy had put them on, with nails from the Sidewinder hardware store. Now the snow was covering the shingles. It was covering everything. A green witch light glowed into being on the front of the building, flickered, and became a giant, grinning skull over two crossed bones.
"Poison," Tony said from the floating darkness. "Poison."
Other signs flickered past his eyes, some in green letters, some of them on boards stuck at leaning angles into the snowdrift. "No swimming. Danger. Live wires. This property condemned. High voltage. Third rail. Danger of death. Keep off. Keep out. No trespassing. Violators will be shot on sight." He understood none of them completely. He couldn't read, but got a sense of all, and a dreamy terror floated into the dark hollows of his body like light brown spores that would die in sunlight. They faded. Now he was in a room filled with strange furniture, a room that was dark. Snow spattered against the windows like thrown sand. His mouth was dry, his eyes like hot marbles, his heart trip-hammering in his chest. Outside there was a hollow booming noise like a dreadful door being thrown wide. Footfalls. Across the room was a mirror, and deep down in its silver bubble, a single word appeared in green fire, and that word was Redrum. The room faded. Another room. He knew, would know, this one. An overturned chair, a broken window with snow swirling in. Already it had frosted the edge of the rug. The drapes had been pulled free and hung on their broken rod at an angle, a low cabinet lying on its face. More hollow, booming noises, steady, rhythmic, horrible, smashing glass, approaching destruction. A hoarse voice, the voice of a madman, made the more terrible by his familiarity.
"Come out! Come out, you little shit! Take your medicine!"
Crash, 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 splintering wood, a bellow of rage and satisfaction. Redrum. Coming. Drifting across the room, pictures torn off the walls, a record player. Mommy's record player? Overturned on the floor. Her records. Grieg, Handel, The Beatles, Art Garfunkel, Bach, Liszt, thrown everywhere. Broken into jagged black pie wedges. A shaft of light coming from another room, the bathroom. Harsh white light, and a word flickering on and off in the medicine cabinet mirror like a red eye. Redrum. Redrum. Redrum.
"No," he whispered. "No, Tony, please."
And, dangling over the white porcelain lip of the bathtub, a hand. Limp. A slow trickle of blood. Redrum. Trickling down one of the fingers, the third, dripping onto the tile from the carefully shaped nail.
"No, oh no, oh no."
"Oh, please, Tony, you're scaring me."
"Redrum, Redrum, Redrum."
"Stop it, Tony, stop it."
Fading. In the darkness, the booming noises grew louder, louder still, echoing everywhere all around. And now, he was crouched in a dark hallway, crouched on a blue rug with a riot of twisting black shapes woven into its pile, listening to the booming noises approach, and now a shape turned the corner and began to come toward him, lurching, smelling of blood and doom. It had a mallet in one hand, and it was swinging it,
Redrum,
from side to side in vicious arcs, slamming it into the walls, cutting the silk wallpaper and knocking out ghostly bursts of plaster dust.
Come on and take your medicine. Take it like a man.
The shape advancing on him, reeking of that sweet, sour odor, gigantic. The mallet head cutting across the air with a wicked, hissing whisper. Then the great hollow boom as it crashed into the wall, sending the dust out in a puff you could smell, dry and itchy. Tiny red eyes glowed in the dark. The monster was upon him. It had discovered him, cowering there with a blank wall at his back, and the trap door in the ceiling was locked. Darkness. Drifting.
Tony, please take me back. Please, please.
And he was back, sitting on the curb of Arapaho Street, his shirt sticking damply to his back, his body bathed in sweat. In his ears, he would still hear that huge, contrapuntal booming sound and smell his own urine as he voided himself in the extremity of his terror. He could see that limp hand dangling over the edge of the tub with blood running down one finger, the third, and that inexplicable word, so much more horrible than any of the others. Redrum. And now sunshine. Real things. Except for Tony, now 6 blocks up, only a speck, standing on the corner, his voice faint and high and sweet.
Be careful, Doc.
Then, in the next instant, Tony was gone, and Daddy's battered red bug was turning the corner and chattering up the street, farting blue smoke behind it. Danny was off the curb in a second, waving, jiving from one foot to the other, yelling,
Daddy! Hey, Dad! Hi! Hi!
His daddy swung the VW into the curb, killed the engine, and opened the door. Danny ran toward him and then froze, his eyes widening. His heart crawled up into the middle of his throat and froze solid. Beside his daddy, in the other front seat, was a short-handled mallet, its head clotted with blood and hair. Then it was just a bag of groceries.
Danny, you okay, Doc?
Yeah, I'm okay.
He went to his daddy and buried his face in Daddy's sheepskin-lined denim jacket and hugged him tight, tight, tight. Jack hugged him back, slightly bewildered.
Hey, you don't want to sit in the sun like that, Doc. You're dripping sweat.
I guess I fell asleep a little. I love you, Daddy. I've been waiting.
I love you too, Dan. I brought home some stuff. Think you're big enough to carry it upstairs?
Sure am.
Doc Torrance, the world's strongest man, Jack said, and ruffled his hair. Whose hobby is falling asleep on street corners?
Then they were walking up to the door, and Mommy had come down to the porch to meet them, and he stood on the second step and watched them kiss. They were glad to see each other. Love came out of them the way love had come out of the boy and girl walking up the street and holding hands. Danny was glad. The bag of groceries, just a bag of groceries, crackled in his arm. Everything was all right. Daddy was home. Mommy was loving him. There were no bad things. And not everything Tony showed him always happened. But fear had settled around his heart, deep and dreadful, around his heart and around that indecipherable word he had seen in his spirit's mirror. Chapter 5. Phone Booth. Jack parked the VW in front of the Rexall in the Table Mesa shopping center and let the engine die. He wondered again if he shouldn't go ahead and get the fuel pump replaced and told himself again that they couldn't afford it. If the little car could keep running until November, it could retire with full honors anyway. By November, the snow up there in the mountains would be higher than the Beetle's roof, maybe higher than 3 Beetles stacked on top of each other. I want you to stay in the car, Doc. I'll bring you a candy bar.
Why can't I come in?
I have to make a phone call. It's private stuff.
Is that why you didn't make it at home?
Check.
Wendy had insisted on a phone in spite of their unraveling finances. She had argued that with a small child, especially a boy like Danny, who sometimes suffered from fainting spells, they couldn't afford not to have one. So Jack had forked over the $30 installation fee, bad enough, and a $90 security deposit, which really hurt. And so far, the phone had been mute, except for 2 wrong numbers.
Can I have a baby Ruth, Daddy?
Yes. You sit still and don't play with the gear shift, right?
Right. I'll look at the maps.
You do that. As Jack got out, Danny opened the bug's glove box and took out the 5 battered gas station maps. Colorado, Nebraska, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico. He loved road maps. Loved to trace where the roads went with his finger. As far as he was concerned, new maps were the best part of moving west. Jack went to the drugstore counter, got Danny's candy bar, a newspaper, and a copy of the October Writer's Digest. He gave the girl a 5 and asked for his change in quarters. With the silver in his hand, he walked over to the telephone booth by the key-making machine and slipped inside. From here, he could see Danny and the bug through 3 sets of glass. The boy's head was bent studiously over his maps. Jack felt a wave of nearly desperate love for the boy. The emotion showed on his face as a stony grimness. He supposed he could have made this obligatory thank you call to Al from home. He certainly wasn't going to say anything Wendy would object to. It was his pride that said no. These days, he almost always listened to what his pride told him to do, because along with his wife and son, $600 in a checking account, and one weary 1968 Volkswagen, his pride was all that was left. The only thing that was his. Even the checking account was joint. A year ago, he had been teaching English in one of the finest prep schools in New England. There had been friends, although not exactly the same ones he'd had before going on the wagon. Some laughs, fellow faculty members who admired his deft touch in the classroom and his private dedication to writing. Things had been very good 6 months ago. All at once, there was enough money left over at the end of each 2-week pay period to start a little savings account. In his drinking days, there had never been a penny left over, even though Al Shockley had stood a great many of the rounds. He and Wendy had begun to talk cautiously about finding a house and making a down payment in a year or so. A farmhouse in the country. Take 6 or 8 years to renovate it completely. What the hell? They were young. They had time. Then he had lost his temper. George Hatfield. The smell of hope had turned to the smell of old leather in Crummett's office. The whole thing like some scene from his own play. The old prints of previous Stubbington headmasters on the walls, steel engravings of the school as it had been in 1879 when it was first built, and in 1895 when Vanderbilt money had enabled them to build a field house that still stood at the west end of the soccer field, squat, immense, dressed in ivy. April ivy had been rustling outside Cormorant's slit window, and the drowsy sound of steam heat came from the radiator. It was no set, he remembered thinking. It was real. His life. How could he have fucked it up so badly?
This is a serious situation, Jack. Terribly serious. The board has asked me to convey its decision to you.
The board wanted Jack's resignation, and Jack had given it to them. Under different circumstances, he would have gotten tenure that June. What had followed that interview in Cromer's office had been the darkest, most dreadful night of his life. The wanting, the needing to get drunk had never been so bad. His hand shook. He knocked things over. And he kept wanting to take it out on Wendy and Danny. His temper was like a vicious animal on a frayed leash. He had left the house in terror that he might strike them. Had ended up outside a bar, and the only thing that had kept him from going in was the knowledge that if he did, Wendy would leave him at last and take Danny with her. He would be dead from the day they left. Instead of going into the bar, where dark shadows sat sampling the tasty waters of oblivion, he had gone to Al Shockley's house. The board's vote had been 6-1. Al had been the one. Now he dialed the operator, and she told him that for $1.85 he could be in touch with Al 2,000 miles away for 3 minutes. Time is relative, baby, he thought, and stuck in 8 quarters. Faintly, he could hear the electronic boops and beeps of his connection sniffing its way eastward. Al's father had been Arthur Longley Shockley, the steel baron. He had left his only son, Albert, a fortune and a huge range of investments and directorships and chairs on various boards. One of these had been on the board of directors for Stubbington Preparatory Academy, the old man's favorite charity. Both Arthur and Albert Shockley were alumni, and Al lived in Barry, close enough to take a personal interest in the school's affairs. For several years, Al had been Stubbington's tennis coach. Jack and Al had become friends in a completely natural and uncoincidental way. At the many school and faculty functions they attended together, they were always the two drunkest people there. Shockley was separated from his wife, and Jack's own marriage was skidding slowly downhill, although he still loved Wendy and had promised sincerely and frequently to reform for her sake and for baby Danny's. The two of them went on from many faculty parties, hitting the bars until they closed, then stopping at some mom-and-pop store for a case of beer they would drink parked at the end of some back road. There were mornings when Jack would stumble into their leased house with dawn seeping into the sky and find Wendy and the baby asleep on the couch, Danny always on the inside, a tiny fist curled under the shelf of Wendy's jaw. He would look at them, and the self-loathing would back up in his throat in a bitter wave, even stronger than the taste of beer and cigarettes and martinis. Martians, as Al called them. Those were the times his mind would turn thoughtfully and sanely to the gun or the rope or the razor blade. If the bender had occurred on a weeknight, he would sleep for 3 hours, get up, dress, chew four excedrins, and go off to teach his 9 o'clock American poets still drunk.
Good morning, kids. Today the red-eyed wonder is going to tell you about how Longfellow lost his wife in the big fire.
He hadn't believed he was an alcoholic, Jack thought, as Al's telephone began ringing in his ear. The classes he had missed or taught unshaven, still reeking of last night's Martians.
Not me. I can stop any time.
The nights he and Wendy had passed in separate beds.
Listen, I'm fine.
Mashed fenders.
Sure, I'm okay to drive.
The tears she always shed in the bathroom. Cautious looks from his colleagues at any party where alcohol was served, even wine. The slowly dawning realization that he was being talked about. The knowledge that he was producing nothing at his Underwood but balls of mostly blank paper that ended up in the wastebasket. He had been something of a catch for Stubbington, a slowly blooming American writer, perhaps, and certainly a man well qualified to teach that great mystery, creative writing. He had published 2 dozen short stories. He was working on a play, and thought there might be a novel incubating in some mental back room. But now he was not producing, and his teaching had become erratic. It had finally ended one night less than a month after Jack had broken his son's arm. That, it seemed to him, had ended his marriage. All that remained was for Wendy to gather her will. If her mother hadn't been such a grade-A bitch, he knew, Wendy would have taken a bus back to New Hampshire as soon as Danny had been okay to travel. It was over. It had been a little past midnight. Jack and Al were coming into Barry on U.S. 31, Al behind the wheel of his Jag, shifting fancily on the curves, sometimes crossing the double yellow line. They were both very drunk. The Martians had landed that night in force. They came around the last curve before the bridge at 70, and there was a kid's bike in the road, and then the sharp, hurt squealing as rubber shredded from the Jag's tires, and Jack remembered seeing Al's face looming over the steering wheel like a round white moon. Then the jingling, crashing sound as they hit the bike at 40, and it had flown up like a bent and twisted bird, the handlebars striking the windshield, and then it was in the air again, leaving the starred safety glass in front of Jack's bulging eyes. A moment later, he heard the final dreadful smash as it landed on the road behind them. Something thumped underneath them as the tires passed over it. The Jag drifted around broadside, Al still jockeying the wheel, and from far away, Jack heard himself saying, "Jesus, Al, we ran him down. I felt it." In his ear, the phone kept ringing. "Come on, Al. Be home. Let me get this over with." Al had brought the car to a smoking halt, not more than 3 feet away from a bridge stanchion. Two of the Jag's tires were flat. They had left zigzagging loops of burned rubber for 130 feet. They looked at each other for a moment, and then ran back in the cold darkness. The bike was completely ruined. One wheel was gone, and looking back over his shoulder, Al had seen it lying in the middle of the road, half a dozen spokes sticking up like piano wire. Al had said hesitantly, "I think that's what we ran over, Jackie boy."
"Well, then where's the kid?" "Did you see a kid?"
Jack frowned. It had all happened with such crazy speed. Coming around the corner, the bike looming in the Jag's headlights, Al yelling something, then the collision and the long skid. They moved the bike to one shoulder of the road. Al went back to the Jag and put on its four-way flashers. For the next 2 hours, they searched the sides of the road using a powerful four-cell flashlight. Nothing. Although it was late, several cars passed the beached Jaguar and the two men with the bobbing flashlight. None of them stopped. Jack thought later that some queer providence, bent on giving them both a last chance, had kept the cops away, had kept any of the passers-by from calling them. At 2:15, they returned to the Jag, sober but queasy.
If there was nobody riding it, what was it doing in the middle of the road?
Al demanded.
It wasn't parked on the side, it was right out in the fucking middle.
Jack could only shake his head.
Your party does not answer, the operator said. Would you like me to keep on trying?
A couple more rings, operator, do you mind?
No, sir, the voice said dutifully.
Come on, Al.